Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. It appears the final act is coming for the historic Forwood School, a landmark in Brandywine Hundred since 1799.
Eventually it did fall into disrepair, and it became what might best be described as a nuisance property. It's really a classic example of what historic preservationists call demolition by neglect.
We'll hear about the building's slow demise and what's next on the property where it stands. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also learn more about how a bill before Congress focused on addressing the opioid crisis could affect the First State, and tell you about a Hagley Museum exhibit heading to China. Plus, we bring you the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. It appears the clock is about to finally run out on the historic Forwood School. After years of slowly crumbling, the building, a landmark in Central Brandywine Hundred since 1799, will soon come completely down before being resurrected in a slightly different form. Contributor Larry Nagengast first looked into the condition and ultimate fate of the Forwood School back in August 2016. And since then, if you looked at it as you drove by on Silverside Road, you might be tempted to say little or nothing has changed. But in his update on the property, available right now at DelawarePublic.org, Larry tells us more about the building's final act and what comes next. I sat down with him earlier this week to discuss what he learned. Let's backtrack a bit first and remind us a little bit about the Forwood School's history and significance.
Okay, well, the school was built in 1799 by members of the Forwood family. Originally, it was a one-room schoolhouse, about 20 feet by 22 feet. Then it was expanded in 1845 to its current size, 40 by 22 feet. Now, I recently came across an 1848 map of Newcastle County that showed there were 9 public schools in Brandywine Hundred at the time. The Forwood School served essentially central Brandywine Hundred, the most recognizable zone boundaries for the district that served are Shellpot Creek on the south and west and what is now Grub Road or Harvey Road on the north. The Forwood School remained in operation as a school until 1939, which made it the longest serving public school in Delaware.
And despite that history, it was essentially allowed to just disintegrate. What happened there?
Well, in the 1940s, the building was converted into a residential property. Members of the Forwood family lived in it or rented it out until the 1990s. The Forwoods made promises to the community that they would keep the building in good shape, but eventually it did fall into disrepair, and it became what might best be described as a nuisance property. It's really a classic example of what historic preservationists call demolition by neglect, which means that property owners let a building deteriorate so badly that it becomes cost prohibitive to restore it, and then a developer finds a more profitable way to use the real estate. Essentially, that's what happened here, and 4 years ago, local developer Joe Setting purchased the 11-plus acre site from the Forwood heirs. Now, that's a nice-sized piece of property in well-developed Brandywine Hundred, and Setting put together a plan to build some townhouses and some retail shops on the land.
Were there any attempts made to preserve it? Were there any other options for this building other than for it to just disintegrate?
Well, despite its history, the building was never designated as a historic site. And so as a result, the Historic Review Board, which is part of Newcastle County government, was powerless to issue any orders that could have stopped a demolition. Now, James Hanby, who is a member of two of Brandywine Hundred's best-known families, the Forwoods and the Hanbys, explored some other possibilities. And Hanby, years ago, was involved with moving the old Brandywine Grange off Concord Pike to a place just to the east of the pike, so that was able to be preserved. So anyhow, one of the things that he looked at was possibly moving the old school to the grounds of the current Forwood Elementary School, which is about a half a mile away. But the building's condition is really too far gone for any move to be possible. As Hanby puts it, it's custom, not mortar, that's holding the stones together.
And as you've noted, that the property is already in the process of being developed. What's going on with that development? So where are we in that process with what's going to be on that site?
Okay. Well, in February, the county council approved a rezoning for the site. So the next step is to have a final approval of the actual site plan. Now, what's going on there can't be stated precisely. Setting gave the county a plan 2 years ago that called for 38 townhouses and spots for a bank, a drugstore, a cafe, a couple other shops, and a dog park. He told me this week that there are probably going to be some revisions to that plan, but he said they're not going to be really great. So there may be some tweaks, some fine tuning. There are other issues there that they've got to resolve as well, lining up the entrance to this new development community with the entrance on across the street to the Granmar Plaza Shopping Center. So, I mean, there's some other traffic and road work concerns to be dealt with as well.
And there will be a new version of the Forward School as part of this new development. Can you tell us a little bit about the plan for that?
Yeah, and that's really the neat thing about what's going on here. Setting tells me that he has hired a masonry contractor who has some expertise in historic structures. This particular contractor did the masonry work for the Enchanted Woods Children's Garden at Winterthur. The contractor is going to dismantle the old school, take it down stone by stone, salvage what he can, and use those materials to build a replica of how the school looked in 1799. So it'll be back to the original size, roughly 20 by 22 feet.
And there will be an attempt as part of this new building to tell some of the old school's history, correct?
Yes, there will. The plan calls for plaques, other sorts of interior signage to tell the story of the school and of the surrounding Brandywine 100 community. Setting Properties will maintain the replica and will open it to the public several times a year and will make it available for tours and visits by school groups.
So what's the timetable for this new school building getting done? I assume it's going to lag behind, I guess, the actual development of the other things you mentioned, the residential stuff, the retail stuff.
Well, actually, it's the other way around. They're going to try to do the building first, the replica first, because Joe Setting would like to use that replica building as the construction and leasing office as the rest of the project moves forward while the townhouses and the stores are being built. Now, if all goes well, he'd like to see the replica completed by the end of the year, and it would have the original 1799 date stone placed in the archway over the front door. However, any sort of an opening ceremony, whatever, to mark the completion of the replica is probably going to have to be delayed until next year, because he wants to make sure that there's sufficient work done on the ground so that there's some paving there, you can drive cars onto the property and so on for any sort of ceremony like that.
But this is a real effort to kind of preserve the history as best as possible, considering the circumstances.
Yeah, most definitely. They're trying to save this piece of history. It's a tough situation. Any time you see a historic structure that falls into disrepair, so they're really making the best of what is an unfortunate situation.
The thing that amazes me is that, because I drive by this building all the time, it's not very far from where I live, this building is still standing after all this time and neglect, even through things like this past winter's storms, which were pretty rough on buildings that are a lot younger than that one. Are any of the people who are involved in this kind of surprised that this building has somehow managed to kind of like stay standing as long as it has?
Well, if you ask a preservationist like James Hanby, he'll tell you, you know, that 2 centuries ago, they made buildings and they built them to last. And that's pretty much what has happened here. I mean, you know, the roof is shot. That's pretty much all covered with tarps right now. And a lot of the wooden framework is in pretty bad shape. But the stones, whether it's custom or whether there is still a little bit of mortar left, yeah, they are still holding together for the most part. Yeah, there are some holes here and there, but yeah, they're hanging on. And given what they endured with all those nor'easters in March, Hanby's not expecting anything to cause them to fall down anytime soon.
And we do have some pictures that you took recently of the building on our website. So if people are interested in seeing just how the building looks right now, even in its deteriorated form, it's a great opportunity for you to do that. The one thing I did want to finish on with Larry is that, you know, the tenor of your piece really seemed like one of kind of disappointment, regret that this was allowed to happen. Is there anything to be learned from this? And if so, does anyone seem to be inclined to prevent a repeat of this type of situation elsewhere?
Well, you know, as I indicated, James Hanby is upset, you know, that his ancestors, the Forwoods, were largely responsible for the building's deterioration. On the other hand, he's pleased that the replica will give his descendants something to look forward, look at generations from now and say they played a part in the area's history. That being said, you know, you can make a case that our state, our county, local governments haven't always moved aggressively to ensure the preservation of privately owned historic structures. And this is particularly true if the owners of properties, for whatever reason, never got around to requesting that the government agencies formally declare a historic site as a historic structure. If that's not done, that does limit government options. So, you know, and then, you know, there are situations where property owners run into problems that make it difficult to maintain a historic site. You know, people do occasionally come into financial difficulties from time to time. You know, and that's it's really another story for another time, trying to figure out what the better way is to do it. For now, all we can do with the Forward School is wait and watch. Watch as the old building comes down, watch as the smaller replica rises, and reminds us of the proud education tradition in Brandywine 100.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. Again, his piece on the Forward School's final days is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We'll hear more about a bill before Congress focused on the opioid crisis and how it could impact Delaware. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions held hearings this week on a bill to combat the opioid crisis. Delaware's Jennifer Donahue testified. She's the Child Abuse Investigation Coordinator at the state's Office of Child Advocate. The number of infants born in the first state with prenatal substance exposure rose more than 50% from 2015 to 2017. In her conversation with Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Donahue outlines how she would like to see federal funds used to help those babies and their mothers.
The goal is for prevention. So there's going to be additional focus on the front end of this crisis as opposed to damage control at the back end. And that's what we want to do in Delaware. So,
and what does that look like?
Prevention, as I said, with the increased mental health access in schools, so that children who are experiencing adverse childhood experiences or ACEs will have early intervention. That will greatly reduce the number of children who are suffering from later mental health concerns, as well as turning to substance use for self-medication. So we're looking at the prevention side. Our SEI committee here in Delaware, we're working with our in-depth technical assistance experts through the National Center on Substance Abuse and Child Welfare. We're working on the awareness part, the awareness piece, and the prevention piece so that we can avoid this cycle of addiction and cycle of dysfunction. So I think part of this bill, if they aim it at the prevention piece, it will greatly benefit families, which is what they're trying to do.
The other thing you've brought up is data collection. Why is that so important to be able to monitor the effects of the opioid crisis?
If you have rich and informative data, you can identify system weaknesses in your state, you know, determine the effectiveness of services that you're delivering to families, and also support some long-term research studies. So what we've done here in Delaware with the substance-exposed infants population, we have a database from 2015 to the present, and we're working with AI DuPont Hospital for Children, their child abuse expert, Dr. Stephanie Deutsch, and they're going to be undertaking a very thorough research study from the cases that we've seen here in Delaware from 2015 to 2017. to see if there's any identifiable risk factors that we can look at, especially regarding those infants that sustained serious physical injuries or those infants that died after being discharged home to their parents. So we're looking at retrospectively this population, but we also hope to continue with a longitudinal study because we are tracking the type of substance that some of these infants are, that all of these infants are exposed to. We can look and see in the future whether or not these children have behavioral health concerns, developmental delays, problems in school. So we're hoping to track these infants into early childhood in order to address future problems that may occur once they go into the education realm.
And also with the rise of infants with prenatal substance exposure, there's been an increased caseload for the investigators at Family Services. Another part of your argument is that we need to be able to fund greater staffing. Can you just talk about the challenges that Family Services has faced with this increase in a prenatal substance exposure?
Sure. So the VFS hotline received close to 22,000 reports last year. A large portion of those are cases involving substance use within families. Some of those cases involve the substance-exposed infants and families. So with the plans of safe care that are required by federal law and soon to be state law, which is our HB 140 AIDS law, there's an additional requirement that we're putting on our DFS workers, and that is to prepare and implement and monitor plans of safe care for these infants and families. Now, this is going to be a much longer type of monitoring than your typical child welfare investigation or treatment. So this is going to put a lot of additional responsibilities on these investigation and treatment workers, and it's going to take a lot more than just an investigation worker. It will also take a treatment worker to keep monitoring long-term this family. So the DFS workers at this point are struggling now with over-limit caseloads because of the increase in the hotline reports every year.
Thanks to Jennifer Donahue, Child Abuse Investigation Coordinator at Delaware's Office of Child Advocate, and Arnick Shalina for their time on The Green this week. Our playlist is up next with a look at a Hagley Museum exhibition heading to China. But first, your local news on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The Hagley Museum and Library in Wilmington is partnering with Tsinghua University in Beijing to mount an exhibition in China in 2018. The unique exhibition, featuring dozens of the museum's 19th century patent models, will travel to four cities in China this year. Hagley's executive director, David Cole, says each patent model tells a unique story of ingenuity, invention, and the entrepreneurial spirit. In this week's Arts Playlist, Cole chats with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about the exhibition, titled Spirit of Invention, 19th Century U.S. Patent Models from the Hagley Museum and Library.
Hagley has a wonderful collection of American patent models that we received from the Rothschild family of New York in 2015. And this collection of over 4,000 models, when added to Hagley's collection that was already approaching 1,000 at that point, gave us 5,000 of these incredible artifacts. And they're really extraordinary, one-of-a-kind creations. The story of the patent model is that in the 19th century in this country, if you wanted to patent your invention, you wanted to secure intellectual property rights to your invention, you had to submit a description of your invention to the patent office in Washington, and you had to prepare some drawings. But you also had to create a scale model of your invention, and that's what patent models are.
So this goes back a long, long way.
Absolutely. Really to 1790. This was the patent system as we know it today, and the patent model requirement was really the brainchild of Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. And in fact, in the early days of the Republic, when the models and the applications for patent protection were submitted, it was Thomas Jefferson himself, as Secretary of State, who was kind of doing double duty as the patent model and patent application evaluator. That didn't last forever, but that was how it was in the early days when our government wasn't so large.
Tell me, does each patent model really tell a story of its own?
It does. Models. What's fascinating about these patent models is that they weren't just created by big name famous inventors. In other words, it wasn't just the Edisons and the Alexander Graham Bells who were submitting patent models. It was really people from every walk of life, representing every kind of industry, every branch of business, every interest you can think of across the United States. And people you've heard of, many, many people you've never heard of. And so it was a broad range of contributions, really examples of just people looking at the world around them, seeing a problem, thinking, I could do that better, and coming up with a new invention, a kind of a better mousetrap, if you would, for improving on something that already existed. And then they would get the idea that maybe I should make some money off of this. And then they would apply for patent protection. This is a very popular idea in 19th century America, when really everybody could see themselves as a potential inventor.
So Hagley Museum and Library basically announcing that it's partnering with a university in Beijing to mount a path-breaking exhibition in China this year. Let's talk about the fact that the U.S. patent models are going to be displayed in four cities starting this month.
That's right. Yeah, this kind of exhibition has never happened. And by that I mean where a U.S. history museum has taken its own collection and traveled it to China and then partnered with a Chinese institution to, in a sense, co-create, or as we would say, co-curate a show. This has not happened before. So it's certainly path-breaking in that sense. But what's really wonderful about this is the exposure this unique collection is going to get. As you mentioned, it's going to several cities in China. We're starting in Beijing at Tsinghua University. Tsinghua is kind of China's MIT, if you would, very science and engineering focused. So it'll be in Beijing first at Tsinghua, and then it will travel to Shanghai, and then to Shenzhen, which is south near Hong Kong, and then to Wuhan. And these are all, you know, small towns of 20 million people or more. And so the expected audience, when you add all the venues together, is projected to go over a million people.
Are you traveling with the exhibit to kick it off, if you will?
We're not traveling to kick it off, although we'll be there soon. The exhibition actually just opened on March 27th in Beijing, and I'll be going over at the end of April for a formal opening ceremony. And in fact, because the show is about these fantastic artifacts that are focused on invention and on intellectual property, preserving intellectual property, the U.S. government and the Chinese government have taken a strong interest in the show. And so one of our opening receptions will be at the home, the residence of the U.S. ambassador, Ambassador Branstad, to China. And we'll be doing lectures and symposia at the American Embassy in Beijing, as well as events at Tsinghua University. So it's going to open to great fanfare in April at these events, and going to attract a lot of media attention in China as a consequence.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that something of this nature has never happened before. Who is responsible? Can you take that credit for making it happen now?
I really can't, but I want to give credit where it's due. The brief story is that I was giving a lecture on the patent models at the Smithsonian, the other institution that has a nice collection of these artifacts. And a person came up to me at the end of my lecture and said, "You really must travel these to China. The Chinese would be fascinated by the story of American invention history." And this person, her name is Rose Chen, had a wonderful connection to China's Minister of Culture to the United States. And so I ended up having an audience, if you will, Hollywood at the Chinese embassy in Washington. And the next thing I knew, some phone calls had been made back to the foreign ministry in Beijing, and we had an exhibition within a week. And I can tell you, in my business, it doesn't happen like that very often. This was a special circumstance.
David, talk about the sponsors a little bit. We don't want to forget about them.
Well, we've got some wonderful sponsors who I think see the potential in this show to tell a story about American innovation, past and present, and to share a story about the importance of strong intellectual property laws in the U.S., in China, and around the world. And several foundations have supported this work, including a local one, the Carpenter Foundation, but also several businesses. Local businesses, Delaware businesses that do a lot of work in China. I'm thinking specifically of the InterDigital Corporation and also CSC. Both of those organizations have a strong interest in developing and promoting their products, their intellectual property in China, and so they're on board to help us share this terrific message.
All right, and also Hagley will be incorporating portions of the Spirit of Invention exhibition into a comprehensive exhibition slated to open in the museum's visitor center in Wilmington in 2020. Talk about that.
That's right. So we've started, ironically enough, we've started on the road with this show, but we will eventually bring it home. And when we do, we will try to do it up big. We will devote significant part of our Henry Clay Mill, our visitor center at the front of the Hagley property, to a permanent display of these models beginning in the fall of 2020. And you will, at that time, you'll be able to come to our visitor center and see hundreds of these models on display, each, as you pointed out earlier, with a really interesting story to tell. There will be interactive opportunities for the visitors to sort of get immersed in a particular story, a particular model, and we're just incredibly excited to be partnering with the Chinese on that as well. So we've co-curated the show that is opening in China, and in turn, they will take some of the expertise they've developed with us, and they will help us create this show at Hagley. And again, that's something that's never happened before. An American museum, Chinese museum, partnering on a show on American history here on U.S. soil.
A lot of firsts going on here.
A lot of firsts.
Hey, David, as executive director of Hagley, and for people listening who may be visiting Delaware, give us some background about Hagley.
Well, Hagley really tells the story of American business history, American industrial history. We sit on 240 gorgeous acres of the Brandywine Creek, and we tell our core story here is really the story of the DuPont Company and its 200-year history of manufacturing on this site. And we have wonderful old vintage mill buildings and mill races and milling machinery that help us tell the story of how water power was used in the 19th century to create an industrial economy. But what we've been doing in recent years is building on that original legacy, and now we're adding to it the history of invention, broadly speaking, a history that cuts across the United States. And that history is really embodied in this incredible patent model collection. And so we've got what one might call the ultimate case history in American innovation in the DuPont Company, but now we've got many thousands of other stories of invention, American invention, to tell on this property, and that's going to be a big focus for us going forward.
Did we leave anything out about the U.S. patent model collection traveling to China? Anything else you want people to know about?
Well, I think the other thing I'm particularly excited about, you mentioned Hagley and what we have going on in our neighborhood here in Delaware. One of, I think, the really nice byproducts of this show in China is that the Chinese are exhibiting not just our patent models and not just telling stories of American invention, but they're also really telling the Hagley story. We have a wonderful video that has accompanied the exhibition that features Senator Coons telling stories about both the American IP system, as well as stories about Hagley and what happened here 100 years ago. And our great hope in this is that by telling the story about Hagley and, more broadly speaking, the other cultural institutions in the Brandywine Valley, that we can attract many more Chinese tourists to this neck of the woods. And we're already starting to see that happen. I think after that show, we'll see even more visitors from China come to our area. And that can really only be good for greater Wilmington and Delaware as a whole.
Thanks to the Hagley Museum's Executive Director, David Cole, and our Kelly Steele for their time in this week's Arts Playlist. For more information about the exhibit, you can visit the Hagley Museum's website at hagley.org. And stay with us as we wrap up this week's edition of The Green with the latest edition of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts, featuring a discussion of how best to communicate with your healthcare provider in this modern age of information and technology. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. In a world with Facebook, Twitter, 24/7 news channels, talk radio, citizen journalism, fake news, real news, audiences are drowning in an overwhelming overload of information. Clearly, a guidepost is needed to identify what are trustworthy and reliable sources of news and information. Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, has created a podcast, A Matter of Facts, to delve into this topic as part of its mission to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. Delaware Public Media is proud to help produce this podcast, and we also thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. And in this week on The Green, we're bringing you the latest A Matter of Facts. Thanks for joining us again on the A Matter of Facts podcast. I'm Tom Byrne, sitting in for Nancy Karabjanian. The flood of information we process these days is hardly limited to news. In almost all parts of our lives, there is more information available than ever before, but that doesn't necessarily translate into better understanding or better outcomes. That's especially true when it comes to medicine and specifically our own health. Where should we look for the best information on our health and our health care? And perhaps more importantly, how can we better communicate with our own doctor? We're joined on this episode by an expert on this topic, Dr. Danielle Ofri. She's a physician at New York's Bellevue Hospital, the oldest public hospital in the country, and a faculty member at the NYU School of Medicine. She's also co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review, the first literary journal developed in a medical setting. She's written extensively about medicine and the doctor-patient relationship. And her latest book, What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear, focuses on communication between doctors and their patients. Dr. Ofri, thank you so much for joining us on the A Matter of Facts podcast.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let me start here. With all the advances in medicine, in treatment, technology, is it more difficult now for people and their doctors to communicate with each other?
I think it is. And I would say it's mainly because of the electronic medical record. You know, if you go to your doctor these days, it's like you're, just sitting in the secretarial pool where your doctor's typing into the computer and hardly looking at you. And that's really, I think, fundamentally changed or limited the ability of doctors to talk directly with their patients.
And you argue that in the midst of all this information and this technology, that really that conversation is still the most important diagnostic tool in medicine. Tell us a little bit more about that. Why is it so important to have conversation rather than, as you said, this kind of like input-output type of relationship?
Well, if you think about the data, what data do doctors need to make a diagnosis? And the truth is the patient's story, what the patient reports to you, is the most powerful data. Other things like lab tests, MRIs, x-rays, that's all, you know, confirmatory. But really the basis of making the diagnosis is what the patient says and, of course, the physical exam. So if you think about the discussion between doctor and patient, not so much as bedside manner or, you know, some nice questions, it's actually the hard clinical data upon which we make our diagnoses, you can see why it's the most important thing. And if we're also thinking about minimizing medical error, which is a topic I'm working on now, we can see that medical error can begin right in the doctor-patient conversation. If doctors aren't hearing what patients say or aren't able to communicate back to the patient what the patient needs to do.
It needs to be an ongoing conversation, right? I mean, it needs to be not just an initial conversation. It needs to be that ability to go back and forth between a patient and a doctor, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, sometimes your encounter with a doctor may just be one visit, an emergency room or a specialist. But if you're lucky to have a good primary care doctor, yes, it will be an ongoing conversation. And for that, I certainly put even more stock in that, because the more you develop good communication skills, the more you understand each other. And so for patients I've known for many years, I know right away when something is wrong, because we've had so much practice in talking that I can tell from their tone of voice, what they say, how they look, when something's out of the ordinary.
I found it interesting in What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear, the book,
And in your lectures, you rely largely on stories to convey your message. How important do you feel that approach is in getting people to connect with the information that you want them to hear and perhaps see themselves in these stories and being able to understand exactly how this dynamic should work?
Human beings are innately wired to find stories the easiest thing to remember. So sometimes, you know, if I ask, if I'm with a medical audience, you know, I ask them some factual question about a test or a diagnosis, and most people don't remember. They have to look it up, which is fine. But if I ask, tell me, you know, the first patient ever died with you, everyone remembers that. And the same thing for non-medical people. We remember stories much more than facts and figures. So I think it's intrinsic to the human race that stories are a way of structuring information and remembering them and making sense of them. You know, if the patient could hand you a checklist of their symptoms, that's not the same if they explain what happened, how it affected their life. That makes much more sense.
And do you hope in some ways that when people hear these stories or read these stories in your book, that it encourages them to tell their own stories when they're with their doctors and communicate with their doctors in that way and perhaps foster these better conversations?
Well, I hope so. And I think it's, you know, an interesting way because of communicating information, because the doctor, in listening to the story, in some ways becomes a character in that story. They're part of the story. And so because the patient's issues affect them. And so the more invested we are in the patient's story, I think the more valuable the information is. And the more, you know, we can make sense of it and help, you know, uncover the problem and also help explain how to solve the problem.
So what can patients do better in this dynamic? What should they be doing when they see their doctor to try and build this conversational dynamic?
Well, there are a couple of things. So one is to recognize that the doctor-patient conversation is the most important tool, and so to expect that. And if your doctor is just sitting in front of the computer and, you know, checking boxes, you're not getting a good medical visit. No matter how well-qualified or highly rated your doctor is, that's not a good visit. So you want to either say something, which you can, or get a different doctor. The second is to prepare yourself for the visit. I know we all here to make a list of questions, but to think carefully. If you have a list of 50 questions, your story will be very long, and it'll guarantee that things will be superficial, right? You can't do 50 issues in a 10-minute visit. So to prioritize and think about the top two or three most important things. And you can even say at the outset, hey, doc, here are the three things I really want to make sure we get to, okay? And the doctor may also have a priority as well. And so if you haven't gotten to it, you can go back and say, you know, we didn't get to this one that's very important. So to come prepared, but to prioritize, and also to make sure you find a doctor who is really valuing the conversation and not viewing it as sort of an affable bonus on the side.
Do you get a sense that a lot of times if you do prioritize those questions, get those top two or three in, that eventually hitting those well will eventually lead to maybe the other 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 things that are on your list?
Oh yes, because often the things are related. And so prioritizing helps also for the patient to focus on what's the most important. And yes, as you said, many things will come up. Or we say, listen, there are five things we didn't get to. You know, let's do my next visit. Let's schedule a phone call. But we've gotten the most important things down.
On the other side of this equation, what do doctors need to do better? Or maybe what I should say is, you know, what should people expect from their doctors in this conversation?
Well, doctors should also view the doctor-patient conversation as the most important thing they're striving for in their interaction with the patient. So although we, you know, are forced to fill in many, many boxes on the computer, remember that's ancillary, and that getting a good history. So I recommend to, you know, I talk to my students and interns about being efficient because we're very busy, is that to take 1 minute and focus on the patient and listen without saying a word. 1 minute of what we call full frontal listening is actually quite a bit. And most patients will get out their story in a minute. And then they listen, you know, I don't want to miss what you're saying. I need to take notes while you speak, and you kind of incorporate the computer. But that you spend 1 minute of solid listening, and that will pay back many dividends. One is you'll get all the information and make fewer errors. But second, you'll invest in a trust with the patient so that when something important comes up, the patient is much more likely to let you know.
I do want to talk about a couple of the situations you bring up in what patients say, what doctors hear. At one point, you tell the story of a patient who receives two different assessments from two different doctors. What should patients do when that type of situation comes up?
Well, one is to try and look carefully at those two assessments and see if there's any overlap. And in this situation, I had completely different assessments. But then just go back to the doctors and say, you know, I spoke to Dr. X and she had this view and vice versa the other, and get their sense of that. Sometimes, as in this case, those two opposite things actually make sense if you look at the perspective of the doctor. In this case, it was a surgeon versus a primary care doctor who just were looking at different aspects of the patient's condition. So it's fine to go back and, you know, readdress it, and it's also fine to get a third opinion.
In some ways, it's not altogether different than what journalists do. You talk to one source, then you go to another source, then you kind of go back to another source to say, here's what this source said. How do you react to it? What do you think of that? There is that same type of dynamic there, right?
Absolutely. And I think also because the human body is not, you know, just a laundry list. And there's many aspects. And you know, sometimes, you know, you might want to give it, for example, chemotherapy to, you know, treat a cancer. And maybe the disease will get better, but the patient may actually feel worse because of the side effects. So depending on which aspect of the illness you're focusing on, you could have a very different opinion.
In your book, you also delve into various studies involving doctor-patient communication. The one on electrical stimulation done on back pain yielded some really interesting results. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what we should take away from that type of information?
Sure. This is one of my favorite studies, mainly because back pain is, you know, every single day I just came from my clinic and I had several patients with back pain. And most patients, you know, go to physical therapy. And I usually think of physical therapy in terms of exercises and massage, maybe the electrical nerve stimulation machine. But I also think of it in terms of how therapists communicate with the patients. And in this study, the patients were going to physical therapy to get that electrical nerve stimulation. So half the patients had the machine, half the patients had sham, machine hooked up, not turned on. And those patients had a 25% reduction in pain, right? Nothing at all. It's a placebo effect. It's great. But turn the machine on, and you get a 45% reduction in pain. So the machine works. But then, here's the really interesting thing. They subdivided the physical therapist. Half were told to be absolutely quiet, and half were told to be engaging. Ask the patient about their pain, how it affects their life, be optimistic it'll get better. So a quarter of the patients got the fake machine, but the engaged physical therapist. And they had a 55% reduction in pain. So the physical therapist, just in talking, communicating, was more effective than the machine itself. And the machine probably cost more than the physical therapist's salary. But the core of the patients that got the machine and the engaged physical therapist had even better, 75% reduction in pain. So it shows that the communication alone can have really hard clinical outcomes, relief of pain, irrespective of having a fancy machine going on.
Do you feel that this study also may have some implications for use of pain medication and its connection to the opioid crisis?
Absolutely. You know, before I was a physician, I had a PhD in biochemistry, and I did my work on opioid receptors. And so the whole aspect of that fascinates me. And I think exploring ways that we can help with pain relief outside of opioid medications is critical. And certainly many of our patients have pain, you know, of all kinds. And it can make me lean on prescriptions because they're easy, they're covered by insurance, but insurance may not cover talk therapy, physical therapy, acupuncture, all the other modalities that can help with pain. And I think if we as physicians and nurses and nurse practitioners recognize that the way we communicate can help relieve pain, well, let's maximize that. And I think for patients, I had a patient said to me, I don't care if it's a dill pickle, you know, if it gets my pain better, then let's do it. So let's, you know, take advantage of the pain-relieving effects that good communication can have as much as we can.
I'm curious, what do you think about the WebMD, the symptom checker websites? Are they useful or can they wind up doing more harm than good?
Well, I think they can be useful in a general sense to point you in the direction, but certainly they, you know, if you're up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you're doing a symptom checker and it lists, you know, 20 rare fatal illnesses, you know, you probably would be better off to close the computer and just get a good night of sleep. So I think it can be a little bit helpful, and I certainly warn people to only use sites that are vetted, you know, by reputable medical sources. I mean, there's all kinds of snake oil out there. So be careful to use places that are real medical places that cite references for what they do and actual people with accreditations that are not just, you know, printed off the internet. But you really do need to see your doctor and talk to them, because those symptom checkers are doing things on average, right? And you're not an average as a person. You're a unique individual. And so you may, 1,000 people have a rash, but your rash may not be what everyone else's rash is. So you do want to see your doctor and a nurse about your symptoms.
So beyond information about one's own health and communicating with your doctor, there's also a lot to digest these days when it comes to health care coverage and insurance, especially when it comes to issues like the Affordable Care Act. What advice do you have for people who are trying to navigate that information when it in regards to their health and health conversations?
Yeah. I mean, it's very complicated, and it's really a shame that it is. I mean, being sick, that's hard enough. So having a fever, being nauseous, being frightened, to have to worry about, you know, navigating insurance, this is really a cruel thing that our society does to Americans, and something that most Europeans don't ever have to think about. You know, and lots of patients will naturally ask their doctors about that, but I have to confess that we doctors are equally confused. So we're not the best source for that. But sometimes you may want to hunt for either social workers in your medical practice or institution, and sometimes there are state, you know, health societies that can help you navigate that. But it's not easy. That is for sure. And if you are feeling sick, you have to have someone else be doing that for you, whether it's a spouse or a parent or an adult child, to take care of the paperwork, where you can just focus on being ill and trying to get better.
You will be in Dover later this month, April 28th, speaking at, say, Delaware Humanities event honoring Bay Health. Can you tell us a little bit about what you'll be covering in that appearance, what people can expect to hear from you that night?
Yeah, I will be talking on the topic of what patients say, what doctors hear. Because I know that there's an enormous gap between how patients present their symptoms or what they want their doctors to hear and what the doctors actually hear. And I'm intrigued from both perspectives, how patients can make the communication work better and more effectively for them, and also how doctors can be better listeners and help understand what the patients are trying to bring to them.
And is this a talk that you've done before? And if so, what kind of, I guess, reaction and feedback have you gotten from it?
I've given the talk in different settings, sometimes with predominantly patients, sometimes with predominantly medical professionals, and sometimes a mix. And I would say that for most people, no matter where you are on the spectrum, it certainly resonates as a topic of concern. Almost everyone, doctor, patient, nurse, feels that the communication that we have is not as good as it should be. And sometimes it's related to not having enough time, or too much computers in the room, or too much to cover. But I think we all recognize that not as good as it should be, and that it needs to be better because it's a crucial part of medical care.
And I do want to remind our listeners that tickets for that April 28th event are available at the Delaware Humanities website, dehumanities.org. Dr. Ofrit, we like to end this podcast by asking all of our guests the same question, and that is, where do you get your news? What are your favorite news sources?
Well, I have four news sources that I use a lot. I'm a daily reader of the New York Times. I read the New Yorker every week. I listen to NPR during the day, and the latest edition, I listen to BBC at night. I often have insomnia, and so BBC runs their radio, you know, 24 hours a day, but our nighttime is their day. So I've been enjoying the kind of international perspective that the BBC gives. I'm up on my cricket teams in Bangladesh and other things happening that we often don't hear about in America.
Well, Dr. Danielle Ofrit, we appreciate you taking your time and joining us here on the A Matter of Facts podcast. We really appreciated hearing from you.
Thank you so much.
The A Matter of Facts podcast is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Its mission is to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. We also thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. And that's all for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenZE, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to everyone who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Nick Schellino, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.